Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, December 3rd, 2005. Our focus today is on simplicity for the holidays. Here's what we have coming up. Our first hour will feature news with a focus on the U.S. and Iraq, followed by Jim Merkel, author of Radical Simplicity, speaking in Keene, New Hampshire on Radical Solutions to a Post-Carbon Future. Our second hour will bring you music, commentaries, and Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. First, some news. From the Associated Press on December 2nd. U.S.-led Iraq coalition steadily eroding. Two of America's allies in Iraq are withdrawing forces this month, and a half dozen others are debating possible pullouts or reductions, increasing pressure on Washington as calls mount to bring home U.S. troops. Bulgaria and Ukraine will begin withdrawing their combined 1,250 troops by mid-December. If Australia, Britain, Italy, Japan, Poland, and South Korea reduce or recall their personnel, more than half of the non-American forces in Iraq could be gone by next summer. Terrence Taylor of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Washington said, "The vibrations of unease from within the United States clearly have an impact on public opinion elsewhere." In the months after the March 2003 invasion, the multinational force numbered about 300,000 soldiers from 38 countries, 250,000 from the U.S., and 50,000 from other countries. The coalition has steadily unraveled as the death toll rises and angry publics clamor for troops to leave. Now, the nearly 160,000-member U.S. force in Iraq is supported by just under 24,000 mostly non-combat personnel from 27 countries. Britain has the second-largest contingent, with 8,000 in Iraq and 2,000 elsewhere in the Gulf region. Ukraine's remaining 876 troops in Iraq are due home by December 31st, fulfilling a campaign pledge by President Viktor Yushchenko. Bulgaria is pulling out its 380 troops after December 15th parliamentary elections, Defense Minister Bliznikov said. In his strategy for Iraq, announced Wednesday, President Bush said expanding international support was one of his goals. Struggling to shore up the coalition, Bush stopped in Mongolia on his recent Asia trip and praised its force of about 120 soldiers in Iraq as fearless warriors. South Korea, the second-largest coalition partner after Britain, is expected to withdraw about 1,000 of its 3,200 troops in the first half of 2006. From The Guardian on November 28, 2005, U.S. may use planes as substitute for troops in Iraq. The Bush administration is considering a plan to put America's awesome air power at the disposal of Iraqi commanders as a way of reducing the number of U.S. troops on the ground. The plan is causing consternation among commanders in the U.S. Air Force, who say it could lead to increased civilian casualties and lead to airstrikes being used as a means of settling old scores. With the White House under increasing pressure over its handling of the war in Iraq, senior administration figures are for the first time signaling the possibility of significant troop reductions. In a departure from previous statements, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, said last week that the training of Iraqi soldiers had advanced so far that the current number of U.S. troops in the country probably would not be needed much longer. However, there remains skepticism about the ability of Iraqi forces to take over from the 160,000 U.S. troops in the country. Under the plans reported in The New Yorker, air power will be used to try to fill the gap left by troop reductions. But with the insurgency operating mostly within urban environments, and planes relying on laser-guided bombs directed from the ground to try to avoid collateral damage, there are fears that turning the process over could lead to increased civilian casualties. From the LA Times on December 1st, Kurdish oil deal shocks Iraq's political leaders. A controversial oil exploration deal between Iraq's autonomy-minded Kurds and a Norwegian company got underway this week without the approval of the central government, raising a potentially explosive issue at a time of heightened ethnic and sectarian tensions. Drilling began after a ceremony Tuesday during which Nekirvan Barzani, prime minister of the Kurdish northern region, vowed, "There is no way Kurdistan would accept that the central government will control our resources," according to news agency reports. In Baghdad, political leaders reacted to the deal with astonishment. "The start of drilling is sure to be worrisome to Iraq's Sunni Arab minority. They fear a disintegration of Iraq into separate ethnic and religious cantons if regions begin to cut energy deals with foreign companies and governments. Sunnis are concentrated in Iraq's most oil-poor region. Iraq's neighbors also fear the possibility of Iraqi Kurds using revenue generated by oil wells to fund an independent state that might lead the roughly 20 million Kurds living in Turkey, Iran, and Syria to revolt." In his speech Tuesday, Barzani, the nephew of Kurdish politician and former guerrilla leader Masoud Barzani, eschewed the language of the law and couched the deal in political terms. He invoked the Kurds' years of deprivation at the hands of the Sunni Arab-dominated government of Saddam Hussein. The announcement of the drilling took many Iraqis by surprise Wednesday. "This is unprecedented," said Ala Maki, a leader of the Iraqi Islamic Party, a Sunni Arab group. "It's like they are an independent country. This is Iraqi oil and should be shared with all the Iraqi partners." Maki said Kurds were trying to have it both ways, controlling the Iraqi presidency and several powerful ministries in the national government, while also trying to lay claim to extra-constitutional powers in the north. Jalal Talbani, a Kurd, is the Iraqi president. From the Associated Press on December 2nd, legality of FORPAY Iraq reports unclear. It is not clear whether a Pentagon propaganda program that paid to plant favorable stories with Iraqi journalists and newspapers violated the law or Pentagon policy, a Defense Department spokesman said Friday. Military officials in Iraq say the program is a critical tool on the Iraq battleground. Lieutenant Colonel Barry Johnson, a U.S. military spokesman, said in Iraq, "The purpose of this program is to ensure factual information is provided to the Iraqi public." But Congress members and the White House have expressed concern. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman John Warner, a Republican from Virginia, said, "A free and independent press is critical to the functioning of a democracy, and I am concerned about any actions which may erode the independence of the Iraqi media." The program came to light just as President Bush released his strategy for victory in Iraq. It includes the need to support a, quote, "free, independent, and responsible Iraqi media," end quote. Senator Edward Kennedy, a Democrat from Massachusetts, characterized the program as a scheme that speaks volumes about the president's credibility gap. "If Americans were truly welcomed in Iraq as liberators, we wouldn't have to doctor the news for the Iraqi people." For a related story on government propaganda, this time here in this country, go to www.fair.org, www.fair.org, for a story called "Why Were Government Propaganda Experts Working on News at CNN?" from March 27, 2000. Our last story is from the Stars and Stripes, which is an army newspaper, European edition, on November 30th. U.S. troops obligated to stop inhumane acts by Iraqi forces. U.S. troops are obligated to stop Iraqi security forces from committing inhumane acts, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said Tuesday. Speaking to reporters, Marine Corps General Peter Pace said, that if U.S. service members see inhumane treatment, it is their obligation, quote, to intervene to stop it, end quote. Pace's remarks come after U.S. troops found a prison run by Iraqis in which detainees allegedly have been tortured. He said the U.S. commander who found the prison acted correctly by working with the Iraqi government, which is investigating the matter. After making his comments, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld intervened to clarify Pace's remarks. Quote, I don't think you mean they have an obligation to physically stop it. It's to report it, end quote. Pace replied, if they are physically present when inhumane treatment is taking place, they have an obligation to try to stop it. Pace did not elaborate on what lengths U.S. troops should go to stop Iraqi security forces from engaging in inhumane treatment. Also Tuesday, Rumsfeld said the United States had a responsibility to train Iraqi security forces and tell Iraqi officials that they lose support from the international community when they act in a way contrary to the world community's values. And now for Jim Merkel, author of Radical Simplicity, speaking in Keene, New Hampshire, on Radical Solutions to a Post-Carbon Future.
Jim Merkel lives in Vermont. He's the founder of Global Living Project and Dartmouth College's Sustainability Coordinator. Originally a military engineer and arms trader, Jim Merkel changed his life at the time of the Exxon Valdez disaster, quitting his job and devoting himself to environmental service and world peace. He downsized his life and 16 years later continues to live simply near the average world income level. Jim founded the Alternative Transportation Task Force in San Luis Obispo, California, and held an elected Sierra Club position while honing urban simple living skills. He lobbied in Washington for wilderness, peace, and Native American rights. In 1994, he received a fellowship to research sustainability in Kerala, India, and walked in the Himalayas. The following year, he founded the Global Living Project and initiated the Global Living Project Summer Institute to discover what a fair share of Earth each individual might be entitled to. With plenty of help from his friends, a permaculture home and demonstration site were designed and built. He instigated a Cycling for a Sustainable Future speaking tour that has logged over 17,000 miles and delivered hundreds of workshops on sustainable living. In 2003, Jim wrote Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. Of this work, Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States, has said, quote, Jim Merkel has written the most persuasive argument I have seen yet for all of us to radically change the way we live day to day. Radical simplicity joins the evidence of science to a fertile imagination. This is a profoundly important book, unquote. At the top of Jim's cycling career, he earned 3 silver medals in the Empire State Games and raced in the Nationals. Cycling continues to be his primary transportation, both around town and for his adventures to Mexico, across Canada twice, and through Europe and India. His passions include wild edible plants, wilderness, and making homestead improvements from articles found around the dump. Please help me extend a warm welcome to Jim Merkel.
Thank you to John. Let's give him a big round of applause. It's a ton of organizing he's done, and what a great job. And thank you all for sticking around on this really exciting night, huh? The rain is pretty incredible. So just hearing the previous speakers brought me back to my military industrial engineer days. And so I was just thinking about what really got me to make some big, deep changes. And when I think about it, I had some ethical crisis going on in the mid-80s. I was traveling all around Europe, and I had a top-secret security clearance, and I designed some cryptographics and some first-strike capability electronics working with TRW. And so now I was trained in foreign military sales. So I was selling items that were on the munitions list, like I didn't sell tanks and machine guns, but those were the other type of items along with cryptographics that you can sell with this kind of information. And so I was meeting with arms dealers around Europe, and we were also selling declassified electronics to anyone who would buy it, really. And I started learning firsthand that the stuff I had designed was getting sold to Iraq and Iran at the same time in the 80s. We were selling this stuff to the most brutal dictators on earth. And I was a right-wing kid. I was a young Republican and kind of that kind of leaning. And this was violating every ethical cord inside of my body. And I heard Dick Cheney speak in the late 80s when I was in Brussels at a military supermarket, basically, where all these like thousands of offense contractors are there selling their stuff. And I heard him give this talk and basically defining, as our previous speaker said, national security as securing our way of life. You know, that was how he openly, overtly defined national security. And so getting resources to keep our high American lifestyle fueled is how we define what we'll go for to war for. And that, I just was appalled at that. And so I was beginning to have this ethical crisis. And when the Valdez oil spill hit, I was in an expensive hotel in Stockholm, Sweden, meeting with the Swedish military. And I started to cry when I saw that spill all over Valdez. And I looked in the mirror across this big polished bar and I said, you know, whenever you point one finger out, three come back at you, right? And I said, this is my fault. I drive to work every day. I've flown 7 intercontinental flights in 1 year. And I said, I have to change, and I didn't know how to do it. And it took me about a year of getting frustrated. But when I got home from that business trip, I started riding my bike to work every single day. And I knew I had to do something. And a year later, I locked myself in my house and for the weekend. And I said, I'm not leaving here till I figure out how the hell I'm going to quit this bloody job. And so I asked myself the question, how much do I need? Instead of the question, how much can I get? I was doing multi-million dollar business deals for TRW. And so I knew how to run numbers. So I ran numbers for my own life. And I figured that at the age of 30 in 1989, if I quit my job and lived on $5,000 a year, I could live for the rest of my life without working. Don't ask me how I came to that, but I did it. And I ran the numbers back and forward. I said, if I take my car off the road, rent 3 of the 4 bedrooms in my house and plant a vegetable garden, it would work. And 16 years later, I'm still living on the same $5,000 a year, and I'm still haven't touched my capital that I had at the age of 30. So that's what radical simplicity kind of highlights, what I've, like how that happened and the details of it. And to me, I want to talk a little bit about a personal response to peak oil. And it was interesting when I applied for this job at Dartmouth, there was 120 people who applied for it, for this job, a sustainability coordinator. I wasn't looking for work. And the job description landed in my inbox about 10 times, and I didn't even look at it. And then finally I opened it, and friends were saying, you know, you should apply for this. And so I dusted off my old resume writing skills and cleaned it up and presented it. And after about 4 months of interviews and maybe 30 or 40 interviews, I got hired to be their sustainability coordinator. And I thought this title, radical simplicity, would shoot me in the foot, right? How is this institution going to hire some guy who wrote a book stupidly titled Radical Simplicity? But they hired me. And I've been there 4 months. And what I'm noticing is, and I heard this from someone who's on the hiring committee, is each interview that I went through, people who were quite conservative, they watched these people on the committee's minds open up week by week, month by month, of the excitement that could happen of us going to sustainability. How exciting it is of an adventure. And so it's interesting now that I'm there 4 months and I've been working with the institution, like our oil bill just went from $4 million to $7 million in 1 year. When that happened, like, their ears are growing like this big, this fast, like to this whole sustainability thing. We have to do really high performance like we have never seen, and then we have to start doing like one halving, like half your energy. We've already done that at Dartmouth. Now we have to half again, then half again, then half again. Now you can put the solar power on the roof. But until you do those few iterations of halvings, and until we do them at home, solar power is a $30,000, $40,000 adventure. At home, I have a $1,200 solar system that I've been using for 2.5 years in Vermont. It fuels me just well. But you have to first do those few levels of halvings if you want to have a $1,200 solar system on your house that doesn't run out in Vermont. So some of this slideshow will be about that. That my personal journey. So here is, what is the response to this curve that we're seeing? And in 1996, I founded a project called the Global Living Project, and our mission was to live equitably among all humanity, all species, and future generations. And this was a research team with 15 people. You know how they sent the teachers up to the moon on the space shuttle? This was a group of educators sent to British Columbia to see how to live on planet Earth in a way that would be sustainable, considering all life and all species. Okay, next slide. And there was a lot of bumps along the way, and a lot of things were learned, but I'll share some of that tonight. Okay. And the tools, for me, there was three very important tools to help me actually transition. One was your money or your life, and part of it is contained in my book. I cover three tools. The other is ecological footprinting, and the third tool I call learning from nature. And with those three tools, I find we can make really big shifts. And your money or your life is primarily a book about finances, and that's the book that helped me have a plan, a financial plan that can survive the bumps. Like when I first started this, Joe Dominguez, who was a co-author of Your Money or Your Life, I met him in the mid-90s, and he said to me, consciousness grows faster than inflation. He had started living on $5,000 a year in 1970, and when I met him in 1994, he was still living on $5,000 a year. People had asked him, well, how do you do that? Doesn't the cost of living affect you? And he would just say, no, consciousness grows faster than inflation. So now it's 2005, and I could still live on $5,000 a year. And people say, well, how do you do it? I'm like, well, it's easy. And I now believe what Joe Dominguez had told me, because I've had over, 16 years free to learn so many skills. I have so much time to learn so much. So now I don't have to pay for someone to fix the car. I don't have to pay for someone to do a little work on the house. I can fix things, and you have time to learn how to grow food and do things. And so I really believe what he was saying. And there's many sides to sustainability. And for me, that's the most exciting part, because the thrill of it is what I think is attracting so many young people. Like, they hired me at Dartmouth because the youth who I interviewed with, a whole bunch of students, and they all gave Jimmy the, like, double thumbs up after the interview process. Like, they wanted this guy who rides his bike around and all this, because they know it's thrilling to be sustainable. And the other part of it is, though, we all like to be nurtured and feel the warmth and comfort and the love from each other. So we need that nurture factor in our transition out of this peak oil thing to really pay attention and love each other. Some paint this gloom doom picture of how we'll all be slitting each other's throats. And I don't even go there at all, because the people I've run into in my life, I've met all sorts of people from the Middle East, and I've never met one I didn't like. I've traveled all over on my bicycle, and I don't carry a gun, or I don't carry any protection. I slept in the middle of a city park for 45 days fasting against this 498 years of genocide. When the quincentennial came in 1992, I slept in the middle of San Luis Obispo City in a sleeping bag, and the drunkards would come up to me and kick me at 2 in the morning, and I just talked to them and nothing happened. So I lost my fear of humanity, and I think that this nurture, that we are very capable of nurturing and loving each other, and that's part of this that makes sustainability very exciting. But the bare bone butt fun of it, like, that to me is the part that's going to make it sustainable, right? If it's not fun, it's not going to be sustainable, because you can't sustain anything that isn't fun, right? But also, it's really serious business, this business of trying to live as a global citizen. It's easy to say in North America, oh, I'm living sustainable. But what do you really mean? Is that sustainable in the context of 6.4 billion humans That's a whole other thing. Because what we have is radical disparity, and the previous speaker mentioned this. For example, the poorest billion, well, the richest billion live on $70 a day, the poorest billion, 25 cents a day. I mean, this is a gap of 250 to 1, and it is growing. Now, my mom ran a daycare center, and 2,000 children came through there. And I was, the way I grew up with eight other brothers and sisters, we all had to work. If you don't work, you don't eat. That's how I grew up. And so you work at the daycare center. That's a family business. And so I was around a lot of kids. And if you say to a child, one for you, one for me, one for you, two for me. There, that's okay. One for you, three for me. And at some point, like one for you, four for me, they're like, wait a minute, not fair. You know, children have an innate sense of fairness, right? They'll say, busted, it's not fair. Children would never let it get to 250 to 1. They would never. You know, but us real rational adults who have become so mature can allow this kind of disparity to grow on planet Earth. So we have 800 million people with insufficient caloric intake, so they have mental retardation or stunted growth from lack of calories. And then in North America, we have 30 billion dollars being spent on diets to reduce our caloric intake. So this kind of craziness is why there's a book, Radical Simplicity. But we have 200 species going extinct each day. What would happen if you were on the 100th floor of a building, and every day you went to a floor below you and took 200 bricks out of the wall and a floor below you? That could go on for quite some time. This is what we're doing to the web of life. And we're watching the crumbling of the web of life all around us. We are at a place like you and I are right on that steep, steep curve. And the funny part about exponential curves, when they multiply together, they just get steeper. So we have population and consumerism growing at an exponential rate. And those are the two things that are making it so bloody exciting to be alive at this time. No other generation can say they have lived through what we are going to live through. And so to me, this is a story about getting small, but without magic dust. I miss the 60s, okay? I was one of those dazed and confused kids. Okay, so in the beginning, there was this arms dealer, right? I was happy enough to sell cryptographic top-secret computers. Oh, yes, but life at the top grew very lonely, and the horrors of war and the cries of the earth disturbed my sleep. I visited the Navajo, resisting, and I witnessed weenies with ties who would stand up and talk for alternative transportation. But when the raging grannies crossed the line at the Nevada test site, and I was there with 5,000 other people, and those grannies, I said, I can't cross the line because I have to go to work tomorrow, you know, and if I get arrested, it's going to be a hassle. And then all these grannies went and got arrested, and oh boy, I was like, give me an affinity group. And I did it, yeah. And what started happening for me is I would see this elder who's doing her civic duty of volunteering. Like, that's what our elders did a decade or two ago, and still there's some around us who do this. They volunteer, and they do all these beautiful things like bringing food to the homeless people, and they're unsung heroes. They're all over our communities, and when I'd hear their stories, I'd start to get tears in my eyes of how beautiful it is. And this, what I started feeling is getting from here to there is so bloody fun. It's so much fun. It's energizing. It's exciting. It's authentic. Like, we get 40,000 TV commercials a year trying to convince us to buy more stuff. You know, you graduate high school, you've seen over 200,000. We're watching, the TV's on for 8 hours a day in the average house. We're sold this, like, lie, you know, this big myth that all you're going to get the sexy girl if you get the car. If you're a woman, you're going to finally be empowered by having this new thing. That's going to make you this awesome person, is by having this thing. And we all know it's not going to happen that way, but we still buy the stuff they're telling us to buy. And it's not authentic. And I think people are dying and hungry for authenticity now. And that's why on the campuses, it's really exciting. I've been touring college campuses by bike now since 1992 or 3. And it's been fun because the college students, after we go and do a little program, they don't get up and run out of the room. They come up and they want to talk for like 2 or 3 hours and then go hit the cafe and really philosophize. And they want to know, how can I do something that's different than having, like, sitting behind a computer till you get a pear-shaped body and staring at a screen, and then, you know, you're going to get debt, a car, and plastic baby toys all over the house, and sitting in traffic for an hour and a half each way. And, like, that's what they're looking at. And they're like, give me an alternative, please. You know, like, do I have to do this for the rest of my life? This is purgatory. And, you know, and students know, like, what are your kids? Like, if you tell your kids, don't smoke, don't drink, don't lie, don't cheat. Okay, I've been around kids a lot. Like, a three-year-old can lie to you so good. Like, if you didn't see what happened, they'll say, oh, no, she did it. And he'll say, no, she did it. And they'll just be sitting there. And if you didn't see it, you couldn't tell who's telling the truth, right, at 3 years old. How did they learn to lie? We taught them. We lie to ourselves every single day. We lie to ourselves every minute. So our kids, they just see it, and they just mimic what we do. And so if you want to really do something authentic that kids, people are going to pay attention to, you have to do what you have to say, do what you believe is the answer. Gandhi told us this. We have to just live the life that we think is the right life to live, and that's how people are going to learn from what we're doing. Otherwise, they're just going to say, you're an imposter. Part of my waking up in some sense was going to India, and a lot. How many here have traveled to the Southern Hemisphere? Yeah, quite a few. Who had, raise your hand if you had a worse culture shock when you returned than going over. Okay, quite a few raised their hand. You get this big culture shock because you see how insane it is what we do here day to day. But it does, when you're in the middle of it, it's like the frog in the hot pot of water. You don't really notice it, how insane it is, but until you come back. So I went to Kerala as part of this research team, and it was a fellowship to learn from them how to live more sustainably. And here they have small families and very high quality of life. It's a population of 30 million people, so that's equivalent to all of Canada, living on an area the size of Vancouver Island. But they have life expectancy close to our longevity in America, high literacy rates, and very, very low infant mortality rate, and less than two child families, and they didn't do it like China. They did it through education and empowerment of women. Wow, what a radical concept that is. Letting women decide their fertility level. These are young men in the village that I would hang out with, and I asked them, well, why do you think Kerala is so different than the rest of India? And what they said is, well, one thought about it, he says, well, we like the peaceful, happy life. Then the other one chimed in and says, well, we have the cooperative mind. I looked at my journal book 9 months later, and I read that phrase, cooperative mind, and it jumped off the page. And I thought, here in our own culture in New England, we had the village green, maybe 15, 20 houses surrounding it. And you didn't need a law or a fence, because you knew when you took your share, when your sheep grazed your share of the green, to bring them home. You didn't need anyone. You didn't need a law, because we were in cooperation with all our neighbors. We had the cooperative mind. So when you have this cooperative mind, if all the world's people lived as the people of Kerala, 80% of the earth would be wild right now. 80% of the earth's planetary areas would be wild. Right now we're consuming the bioproductivity of the earth at a rate of 120%. We're in 20% overshoot. Humanity as one species is consuming the planet plus 20% every year. That's why we're seeing desertification, CO2 levels rising, ozone depletion, because we're over-consuming. Just the wealthy billion consume the entire annual production. The poorest 5 billion consume the 20%. So 60% of spending is on healthcare and education in Kerala. You see abundant food. I visited an open prison with 280 murderers, and I got to see them up close, like really close. And I was walking right by all these murderers, and I thought, God, this is exciting. And I'm talking to the guard there in the khakis. He's got no weapon, and there's no fence around the prison. And so my first question to the guard is, I had an interpreter. I says, well, what's the philosophy of the treatment here? He said, well, we better treat them nice. They're all murderers. And In 30 years, they've had one escapee and one repeat offender. Well, when I left Kerala, I knew I had to come back and do something with this fellowship. And I was supposed to bring ideas of sustainability back to North America. And my brain had been sizzled, like you put high voltage on me and just like short-circuited everything, because everything I had ever learned had been flipped on its head. And so I thought, okay, I've read about people like Edward Abbey and, you know, Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac who just went to the mountains. So I said, I'm going to walk the Himalayas for 2.5-3 months and hope that a vision just strikes me like, oh, now I know what I need to do when I go home. So that's what I did. And out there walking in the Himalayas, and one of my first passes that I crossed was over 17,000 feet. It was still about 25 foot of snow, and the peaks around me are 24,000 feet, and I ended up getting whited out, so I had to sit in my tent with three others, a Nepali who was trying to walk over the pass and didn't make it. He had sneakers with holes in them and a blue jean jacket. We had him in the tent and two others, and we sat it out. And 7 days we were over the pass, and we were into these villages that are, you know, you can only get there by walking. And here you see it's a Tibetan Buddhist area, and all these piles of rocks you pass as you enter the village, each one engraved with the sacred text of the Buddhist mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And so you see it in all different presentations. And when the people walk into the village, they count their 108 beads, or they spin their prayer wheel on their way into the village. So they only bring peace. And when they go from the village out to the world, they count the beads, but they walk on the opposite side of the stones. They count the 108 beads, or they spin their wheel and get their mind relaxed. So when they go out to the world, they only bring peace. So they've lived up here for over 1,000 years without destroying this ecology. And I witnessed a very, very timeless, beautiful quality of life there. And if you see the little village out on the precipice, you can see their ecological footprint just by looking. Now, if you wanted to see my ecological footprint, you'd have to go out to space and look down from space and wait for the Earth to spin, and you'd see the bananas that I eat every now and then from Ecuador, and you see a little patch, and that's my ecological footprint for bananas. Keep spinning, and you'd see the cotton in the middle of the southern or whatever, the Midwest or whatever, wherever it's growing. You'd see, you'd have to look all around the whole planet to see the shirt that's maybe stitched over in China. And you'd finally add up and see the little patches all around the globe to make up my footprint. But here you could see it just from a precipice. I returned home, and my idea that struck me was to start a project in North America where we lived as a global citizen, but in the context of North America. So here's Dr. William Rees, who founded the idea of ecological footprint. He's a department head at the University of British Columbia. You can get a PhD there in ecological footprinting. And it's a systematic method of adding up all the little patches around the earth and say, this is how big of an impact it is for me to live my life day to day. And it's done for 150 nations every year by the UN. And they tally up 250 of the largest consumed commodities at the national level each year and do an import-export analysis so you know national consumption. It's a very robust methodology. And so we formed this project in British Columbia, set in a context where there's still cougar, grizzly bears, and wolverine, and we operated there for 8 years to learn, because what I didn't see in India was healthy biodiversity. So here we said, let's live in a place where there's still wild, no significant species extinction, and learn how to live within the context of a wild ecology. But at the same time, take back what we learned in India. So we measured every single thing we consumed for 6 weeks. And if you want to know if you're sustainable, you first have to know how much earth there is. Okay? So if you subtract the deserts, oceans, and ice caps, you have 28.25 billion acres of bioproductive space. You divide it by the 6.4 billion people, we each get about a 4.6-acre personal planetoid. You don't get a mermaid. But you can use this personal planetoid any way you'd like. If you use the whole thing, there's no room for other species. So here you see in the U.S., you would need 5 Earths if everyone on Earth lived like a North American, because we need 24 acres per person. Now, in Europe, it's about half. Mexico, half again. China and India, or the Global Living Project, is half again. So we were able to get our footprints above India and below China for 5 different research teams. Okay, 5 teams. But that was easy enough because it's during the summer. So then we took it on to do it year round. And one of our big things we learned is, look, facing reality, there's only one Earth. It's finite. Earth is finite. When you hear economic growth on a finite planet, that's the ideology of a cancer cell, as Edward Abbey says, right? Just doesn't work. So there's only so much Earth. If you pull the covers over your head, your feet will be cold. This is face the fact there's one Earth, and then our systems, and we can design systems that are could be sustainable. What we did during our project to get our footprints down to that 3-acre zone, for one, is we did permaculture. So we grew a lot of our own food. We wildcrafted about a third of our food each day, a third of our salad from the wilds. There's so many edible plants. We made it. This is a bread baking oven like you'd see in Mexico. Whatever we didn't grow or wildcraft, we would buy from a local organic producer and bring it back on bike trailers. And here we are. This is Vicki Robin in the white, and she actually participated in eating roadkill deer barbecued. I've brought home about 5 deer now and butchered them, and I won't eat meat except if it's roadkill. And Sandy is a vegetarian now. She did violate her vegetarianism to try this roadkill deer. She said, I think I can go with that. And she really liked it. Now, a big part of our project, I said, is learning directly from nature. We use these tools of analyzing, quantifying very accurately our consumption on Earth. And we do it both in terms of finances and in terms of footprint. But then also, how do you really learn and get inspired? And how do you know on a deeper level what are the needs of other species? When you get to know, say, your best friends and your family and your children on an intimate level, you know what they need. And you're ready to do anything. Like parents are ready to do anything for their children. And or your siblings, your brothers and sisters, your grandparents, your best friends. You'll do anything for them when they need your help. But now when the other species, if you live in a, like most of us end up spending, if we add up the time we spend in nature, like wild nature at the end of the year, how much time is it really? We may go hiking a little. If we spend, say, 1% of our time in nature by the end of the year, for some of us that may even be a lot, but we won't really understand the needs of the other species. We won't really know it. We could read about it in a book, but it's not going to sink in like your own child sinks in, or your own friend, or your parent, your mother sinks in. So that's why I'm saying you need to spend time. I don't like to ever say need, but if we do, we will have more compassion for the other species. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. Because really, what does this mama grizzly bear need? I mean, she's going to have some cubs, and she's going to really care for them. Like a grizzly mom, she really loves her cubs, man. She loves them to death. The more you learn about grizzlies, I lived in their habitat for about 8 years. And I'm not afraid of them. I have an immense respect. But they will do a lot of things to make sure they have a good future. And how do we allow her to have that future that she wants to have? We can do it. I found out it's not that hard. But we have to live different. You can't bring your dogs and your cats. You can't leave your garden unfenced. Put a nice big fence and don't attract them in. And you can live there in the middle of the wilderness and not be having to kill bears. We didn't have one problem bear. And the people lived on our land before us shot 2. They moved to a new piece of land and shot 2 more bears. Why? Because they were problem humans. So part of our experiment in doing this year-round was to build this straw bale house. Cost us just $1,500, including the wood stove, electricity, and running water and phone line. And it was built from most of the materials on the land, straw bales and timbers. And it had an ecological impact 25 times lower than standard production. So if we said earlier that our personal planetoid is 4.6 acres, that's just dividing the Earth by the 6.4 billion. Now, if we say we want to leave 80% of that planetoid wild for the other species, so humanity takes 20, and the 25 million other species get 80% of, say, my personal planetoid, I would have to live on 1 acre, roughly. My firewood, 1 cord of wood takes 1 acre to grow. Like after 80 years, if you took 1 cord off of 1 acre, you'd still have the forest intact. So I was burning two cords of wood. My biggest footprint item after I got rid of the car, you know, hardly used the car, was my firewood. So this cabin only burned one cord of wood a year, two of us living in it. So it was a half a cord each, and it was 300 square feet. So we reduced our square footage per person from the North American average by five times. You know, we in North America have doubled our square footage per person in the last 20 or 30 years, and we're way above what the world's square footage is. A guy from Africa was visiting, and he came and saw this. He's in a band, a musician, and he's just smiling. And I says, well, what's so funny? He says, oh, just like Africa, seeing the finish. And then I said, well, how many people would live in a house like this in Africa? He said, oh, four people. So then all of a sudden I felt like, wow, we had a lot of space. In the basement of that little house was a root cellar, and I call this one of the sustainability wonders of the world, because for 12 years I haven't had a refrigerator plug at all. No refrigerator. How do you do it? Well, you dig a hole in the earth. Very simple. We've done that forever. No other device that I know of can store like 1,000 pounds of vegetables for 6 months, and you can still pull a carrot out in May and crunch on it, and it's great. And I've been doing that now for a bunch of years, and it works fantastic. Now, since I returned from India, I've been washing my clothes by hand, and that's to put myself in solidarity with over a billion, maybe close to 2 billion women who wash clothes around the earth. And we've also experimented with things such as going south without fossil fuels. You ever try that? Just say, hey, it's Mexican night over at my house. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, and just have some fun with it. And part of the work after trying all these experiments was to take it on the road and share it. And so we started this Cycling for Sustainable Future bike tours. And we go in British Columbia over seven mountain passes till we finally hit the coast of Vancouver, because I lived on the interior. Then we tour up and down all the way to California some years and visit universities. So there we would do workshops on how to do your footprint and things like that and get students fired up. And this last year, I'm still doing bike tours, and we've toured around New England three or four times now. And this last year, my book came out in Spain, and it's called Simplicidad Radical, and I love that name. And you see it's got a different cover there with the snail. And so I was invited to tour all over Spain and promote the book, and that was a lot of fun. So the tours are still going on, and here you see the scavenging a sustainability coordinator at Dartmouth. This is in my first week. I got a call from a 77 alum, and she says, God, you wouldn't believe what's happening all over campus. The students are moving out, and the dumpsters are full. Now, I'm a self-proclaimed dumpster diver, man. I don't even hide it. So here I am with my tie and everything, and I'm going out with my bike trailer. And I've got, look at the wicker baskets. Those are my office now, and they're really sweet. They're like brand new. You see in the trailers that clothes rack, because I ride the bike to work every day, so I hang my clothes on this rack. You see the art supplies in there? I found a full ream of paper in the garbage. Like there was a little coffee and shampoo spilled on it, but it was wrapped in the cover still. I just took the cover off, and the whole ream of paper was perfect. The students had thrown it away. It was full of cans, jars of olive oil, not even the seal broken, and it was organic. This was in the trash. So, like, this was my first week at Dartmouth, and it was a lot of fun. And I've got to say, after 4 months, I have to do some things to keep sane, because I was used to living on the land for 16 years. So now I'm every day, not 4 days a week. I wanted three. I settled on 4 days. But so to keep sane, I still eat these wild plants. And that's one part of it, to bring the wildness into myself. And I find that I need to tend my own fire. And part of that is just to spend some time out and just feel the energy of the night, feel the energy of the stars, feel that warmth of the fire, and just take a deep breath and relax and enjoy and just feel the chill on my back and the warm on my front. And okay, great. And it's a time where, for me, it builds my energy so I can go, say, back into Dartmouth. Or for a lot of us, we're working for peace or we're working for the environment. And I think we need to take care of ourselves or else we're going to really burn out. And I know what that feels like. So this is my little cue to really take care of yourselves. And the other part of this, for me, of getting free of oil is to look at yourself as being a prosumer, not just a consumer. So this house produces energy. And we're in an old homestead that was founded by Laura Waterman, who's written 5 books on a manual typewriter, and we still carry the water from the creek and buckets and all that. Making our own medicines. Here's a timber frame poop palace. It's a composting toilet. It's the first one I've ever heard of on the planet Earth. Timber frame, mortise and tenon joinery done by a team. We run workshops on our land each weekend. There's a little brochure over on the table. We do one on medicinal and edible plants, on timber framing, all these different topics. Here's one on gardening for self-reliance. And some of our biggest problems we have, I find, is trying to eat all the food after you grow it. It's just too much sometimes. Last year we grew our own grains, and this year again, so we're eating our own pancakes. Here we thrashed it out on our own floor. So you have blueberry pancakes from your own flour, ground by hand. You have blueberries jarred. We have our own honeybees, and we have our own maple syrup that we make. And that, in the middle of the winter, is like, you can't buy that, right? And so this year we even did an Antioch Master's class on our land. And here we had them sort out all their stuff and do their footprint on their first day. They don't know what they got themselves into. But it's, you know, after you do your footprint, you need some comic relief. And this team of women were really empowered because they actually plumbed this hot water solar system up. And they hadn't sweat pipes or wrapped Teflon tape around plumbing fittings and learned a male from a female. I think they knew that piece, but when they really got to say it out loud, like, I need a nipple, or do you got a male threaded union, you know, or something, they enjoyed that piece of it, too, learning those plumbing parts. And then for some of them, it was a time to really define their practice. And there's things you learn, like shit from Shinola and a solar cooker from a spaceship, and it was really fun. And I think the folks are realizing that having sharp tools really helps. And this is me thrashing the winter rye with these little blocks. It didn't work, but it was very much a fun thing. And Wendell Berry talks about taking back these proxies. Like, so the corporation's going to keep us warm, right? That's what we think. But we can meet our needs without fossil fuels, right? The corporations. Yeah, but how will we get around? You know, we wonder, who will feed us? Huh? How will we stay warm? The myth is if we don't buy into mother culture, we're going to freeze, right? And in Gandhi said this in 1939, you cannot build nonviolence on a factory civilization, but it can be built on self-contained villages. And I think it still applies. I took this job at Dartmouth, and I think what compelled me to take it was the Iraq War. When war is going on, I feel just torn apart inside. Like, we've killed 1 million people since 1989. In 1989, Iraq had the highest health care and education in all the Middle East, the best. They had $3,600 a year income. Now they have $500 to $600 a year income. Imagine your whole country being brought from $3,600 a year to $600. Infant mortality rate went from 40 in 1989 under the brutal dictator of Saddam Hussein to 107 under Bush. You imagine 107 children dying out of 1,000 before the age of one, and Condoleezza Rice says she's after the moderate Muslim? How the hell are you going to get the modern Muslim on your side when you have an infant mortality rate higher than India in the 60s? Really? You know, this is a disgrace what we're doing there, and that motivated me to work at Dartmouth. And I can't work on peace really too much because I get too passionate and I fry. And so I'm working on a solution, in a sense, only because I don't have the choice to work for peace, really. I get too crazy inside. Here's a Gary Snyder poem. He says, we need no fossil fuels. Get power within. Grow strong on less. Grasp the tools and move in rhythm side by side. Flash gleams of wit and silent knowledge eye to eye. Sit still like cats or snakes or stones. As whole and holden as the blue-black sky, gentle as wolves, tricky as a prince. In our work and in our place, in service of the wilderness, of life, of death, of the mother's breasts. That was a Gary Snyder poem written back in the 70s in the Turtle Island collection. And it's very apropos for today. And I just want to ask, who here has ever fallen in love? Like, anyone here? Okay, I see most of the hands up. Everyone's fallen in love. No? Okay, yeah, okay. At least once. Now, can you remember the first month, what that was like? Remember that? Did you do some really crazy things? Like silly, like, you know, stay up all night, like, and then go to work the next day, or try things you never thought you'd try, food you never thought you'd eat, and you started to have dreams together, right? Did any of you ever have dreams with your partner, like the first month, like feel so excited and giddy and like anything is possible? And did it ever feel like sacrifice, you know, to try new things and change your old behaviors? Did it ever feel like sacrifice or like, oh, we're so willing, right? And so what I feel is if we fall in love with the earth like this, the same way, we'll do anything it takes to be sustainable. So thank you so much for listening tonight.
On the first day of invasion, my leader said to me, they're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the second day's invasion, my leader said to me, they have weapons of mass destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the third day of invasion, my leader said to me, they won't allow inspections.
Weapons of destruction,
they're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the fourth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they didn't sign the biological weapons treaty.
Won't allow inspections.
Weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the fifth day of invasion, my leader said to me, demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction. They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the sixth day of invasion, my leader said to me, all they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the seventh day's invasion, my leader said to me, they just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the eighth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the ninth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they helped to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the 10th day of invasion, my leader said to me, they have invaded other countries.
Help to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the 11th day's invasion, my leader said to me, they were not fairly elected.
Invaded other countries.
Help to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
On the 12th day of invasion, my leader said to me, they plan to use the bomb.
Not fairly elected.
Invaded other countries.
Help to train Al-Qaeda.
Execute their people.
They just can't be trusted.
All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
And they're the most dangerous nation in the world.
That was Charlie King and Karen Brandaugh with The 12 Days of Invasion.